This is an interesting passage. This is one that requires a special handout, and you may want to have this out where you can see it, because there is a lot here that we are going to try to condense as much as possible to have an idea of what all is being communicated in this passage. So we have been considering the last vision of the book of Daniel. Of course, the book of Daniel has several different visions in it. The earlier ones are preparatory for the last one, and this is the beginning of the last one. Daniel chapter 10 plus verse 1 of chapter 11 introduces the vision that follows. It in and of itself had somewhat of a vision of a being in it. That was part of Daniel's preparatory experience of this chapter before the revelatory vision which was coming, and it left him in a weakened state of exhaustion from the anticipation of what was coming. And there are two parts to this vision. This is somewhat of an overview, so you know what's coming. There's the immediate future, dealing with events from Darius through Antiochus, Epiphanes, chapter 11, verses 2 through 35. And then there's the distant future, which is going to be dealing with something that Daniel had brought up in chapter 9, the 70th week, which is related to the tribulation period. That's chapter 11, 36 through 12, 4. And then the rest of chapter 12 is a conclusion to this revelation. So our focus today is going to be on chapter 11, verses 5 to 20. The first part of chapter 11 deals with the background leading up to Antiochus the Fourth or Epiphanes. He is a major player that we need to consider, but there's a background to that that we need to think about. So the angel that had been revealing this now describes the affairs of two kingdoms whose kings he called the king of the south and the king of the north, and the reference to the king of the south and the king of the north needs to be recognized. It's more of a title, it's a designation, and they are representative of different characters. It's not the same king of the north, king of the south, all the way through. It's basically talking about the leader of the north kingdom and the leader of the south kingdom. So it's helpful to keep that in mind. And again, you need the cheat sheet to help you keep this straight, because there's just a lot here. These north and south directions are in relation to Israel, the land of Daniel and his people. So that's going to be significant. So the nation to the south was Egypt, and the main initial character was Ptolemy, or some prefer Ptolemy, but you can figure out whichever way you wish, and his descendants. So it's that's referred to as the Ptolemaic kingdom of the south associated with Egypt. And then the kingdom to the north is what later became known as Syria, and it had other designations, but Syria was a main part of that, and that was the kingdom under the Seleucids, or Seleucus the First is the first one, and then his heirs that follow. And then this is going to take place, this breakdown of this north and south kingdom designation, is going to take place after Alexander the Great's breakdown of his kingdom into four parts. And the four parts the four different generals that were under Alexander. And we're going to be looking at two of those. And that is the Syrian, the Seleucids, and the Egyptian, or the Ptolemaic kingdom. And the Syrian kingdom is going to be the larger of them in terms of the territory that it encompassed. And it included Asia Minor and in the western direction, and then went as far as into India in the east. So we're talking pretty good size areas here. And what we need to recognize, and this is the crucial thing, is the land of Israel stood between those two, between Egypt and Syria. as we recognize today. And there have been no small number of occasions when there has been ongoing conflict that continues even today between the North and the South over the years. And so the territory in between was sort of a buffer, and it was the area of coveted ground that each tried to possess. And so we need to keep that in mind as we think, because Israel was at the crossroads of civilization. It was small, but it was critical, because to the east it was more desert and very desolate kind of country. To the west was the Mediterranean Sea. So if you wanted to go from the north to the south, where do you go? Right through Israel. And the Israeli area was a place of commerce because it was on the crossroads. And that's why the Jewish people have been associated with individuals of great commercial skill, partly because of that very thing. So we want to look at the initial exploits of the Kingdom of the South. And we'll just look at this text initially just to identify the first of these places, and then I want to go through some detail on it. The king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now, let's save most of that for looking at in just a moment after our first point, but I want to give us a summary listing of these kings of the north and south. And don't confuse this with the Civil War. That was a different thing that came much later. So we start with a summary listing of these kings. So we start with the Seleucids, and this is what you have on your sheet, but let me just touch on this just so that you can kind of think about who we have here. We have the first one, Seleucus, also referred to as Nicator, probably has the idea of a conqueror. The various kings often took to themselves additional names that would be associated with them, that was sort of like their nickname that they wanted to be thought of as. It was sort of their icon that they would put on their Facebook page, something like that. So you have the dates there. I'm not going to mention all these dates. You can check them out. Not everybody's a history nut, so I realize that. But see, there's the passage where this person is referred to, but the name isn't given in the text because it's just not stated. So we will try to tie the historical event as we are able to look back and tie it with what the text is talking about. So Daniel 11:5 is going to be referring to Seleucus the First. Then Antiochus the First is not mentioned, but he is a necessary connection because he's the son of Seleucus the First and the father of Antiochus the Second. And you notice that Antiochus the First was not shy to pick a name, a nickname to go with him. Soter, anybody recognize what that is? Savior or deliverer. Like we get our word soteriology from that, which is the doctrine of salvation. Of course, the next one's pretty easy. Antiochus, Theos, God. I mean, why not? You're the top dog. You can be whatever you want. So that's what they do. Then Seleucus the Second, and what you have to try to watch for here is the interchange between them. You think you've got it figured out. Okay, Antiochus the First, let me go back to Seleucus, and it's going to kind of be that way. So try to keep up and keep track. You may have to look back at that a few different times, and that's going to be found in Daniel 11:7-9. And then Seleucus the Third, and then Antiochus the Third, also referred to as the Great, and then Seleucus the Fourth, Philopater. I'm guessing that may be loving father is what the designation is there. And then, of course, Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, he's going to be a real character that we will look at the next time we get into this text. So just recognize you either have a Seleucus or you have an Antiochus, and it's kind of mixed up in there. Fortunately, when we get to the Ptolemies, it's a little bit easier. This is going to be dealing with Egypt. This is the southern. It's just Ptolemy the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth. So that one's a little easier. So remember, Ptolemies, Ptolemaic kingdom, that's the south, that's Egypt, and then either Seleucus, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever, and then Antiochus, and those are kind of mixed through a little bit. So that hopefully will help just a little bit. So these names probably don't mean a whole lot to us. You may have heard some of them before. But I thought if we had at least something to give you a clue as to how they fit together and which text goes with it might be helpful. And they do have significance with the text. That's why we note it that way. So let's pick up again at the text. We're going to read verse 5 again. Also the king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes. So we need to figure out, okay, who is the king of the south here and who is one of his princes that shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And then verse 6, at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Now, if your head isn't kind of going, whoa, what in the world are we talking about here, I would be surprised because it's a little bit overwhelming. And we will try to look at narrowing down some of the details just a little bit. And then verses 7 and 8, but from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of gold and silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So you have an idea that there are some political movements going on between the king of the north, the king of the south, and all of that. So that's at least a start. So identification of the text with the initial historical characters, that's kind of helpful. Again, we are looking back on this, and you will note at times I will have reference to something in the future tense, as in this is what the text says is going to happen, and sometimes I will simply reference it as this was what happened. And I kind of go back and forth because it helps in my mind to remember that there's an element of prediction and there is an element of fulfillment, and they are kind of working together from our perspective because we're looking back. So the king of the south is identified as Ptolemy the first. So that's helpful. Again, looking at verse 5, this is Ptolemy the first Soter. He was one of Alexander the Great's most powerful generals, so he had some clout. He proclaimed himself as king of Egypt in 304 BC. That's partway through his time where he had authority over that area, but he officially proclaimed himself king at a particular time. He was a rather ambitious monarch who sought to extend his holdings into Cyprus and Asia Minor and Greece, so he was wanting to move north and take over more territory. And his dynasty ruled Egypt until 30 BC. Just to give you an idea of how long. So that was about the time that Rome took over as the major power in the area. So we need to keep in mind that this is before, it's kind of when the Greek Empire was sort of splitting and not totally declining, but in the process of it. It still had an influence, but it was going to be replaced by Rome coming up just prior to the time of Christ. Then there's a reference to the prince under the king of the south, and that is a reference to Seleucus the first Nicator. He was another of Alexander's most prominent generals, and he would gain power eventually over the king of the south, and there's a lot of back and forth that's going to be going here. He gained authority to rule Babylon in 321 B.C., but in 316 B.C., another of Alexander's generals, Antigonus, attacked Babylon. And so Seleucus sought help from Ptolemy the First, or in other words, from Egypt, and then with Ptolemy's help and the superior power that Ptolemy had at this time, he was able to gain control of Babylon. So it's in this sense where he was seeking the help of Ptolemy that he is referenced as a prince and submitted to him to his superior military strength and support against Antigonus. So Seleucus the First eventually ruled all of Babylon and Media, Persia area, and Syria, which would be an area much larger than that of Ptolemy. So he was sort of utilizing the strength of Ptolemy for a time, and he is recognized accordingly. He assumed the title king of this area of Syria in 305 BC, and therefore he would be officially recognized as the king of the north. And his dynasty lasted until 64 BC. So that's sort of setting the stage of the main characters here. Then Ptolemy II took his father's place as king of the south. So again, king of the south, we're talking about Egypt. Ptolemy I died in 285 BC, and he left his throne to Ptolemy II, Philadelphus. Philadelphus, it should be noted, was actually friendly toward the Jews, and he sponsored the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek. The LXX it's referred to would have been in Alexandria, Egypt. So that kind of ties in another major event to sort of hang at least a point of connection to here. In the north, Seleucus I was the victim of an assassination in 281 BC, and then his son Antiochus I, Soter, began ruling in his place. Antiochus I died in 262 BC and left his son Antiochus II in power. So Antiochus I didn't last all that long. Again, this is the son of Seleucus. And then so the next one, so Antiochus I really wasn't much of a main character in the story of things here. But we move on to Antiochus II. Then Ptolemy II of Egypt and Antiochus II of Syria were contemporaries, but they were bitter enemies. Now, when you think about it, back up in time to under Alexander, the Seleucid and the Ptolemy main initial characters were on the same team. And now they've got their own lands, and now they're fighting each other. So uncharacteristic of humanity, right? You see two kids in the sandbox, and you see the same thing. I want that. No, I want that. I want that. No, I want that. And so it just, they get a little bigger, and the sandbox just gets bigger. So these were not really good friends much of the time, but they finally made an alliance about 250 BC, and they sealed this alliance with the marriage of Ptolemy's daughter, and her name is Berenice. I think it looks like very nice. I think that sounds better, but we might just call her Bernice because it's probably easier. And so Ptolemy II's daughter married Antiochus II, and that's a little complicated as well. So when Ptolemy II died in 246, Antiochus II took back his first wife, Laodice, whom Antiochus had divorced to marry Bernice. Following that, do I need to pause for a moment and let some of that sink in? It just goes on and on, really. So Laodice is the woman for whom the town Laodicea in Asia Minor is named, referenced in Revelation 3:14, a couple other places. Similarly, the towns of Antioch in Syria and in Asia Minor are named for this Antiochus II. but there were several Antiochuses, so it could be associated with any of them. Of course, Antiochus, or Antioch of Syria, and Antioch of was the capital of Syria, and that's the same place that Paul began his missionary journeys from, if you remember in the book of Acts, by beginning in chapter 13. So that's just a little bit of, again, connection of some of the historical events with some of the names and places. But after after Antiochus divorced Laodice and married Bernice, then to get revenge, Laodice, or associated with town Laodicea, Laodice, had Bernice and her infant son by Antiochus murdered. So then Laodice also poisoned Antiochus II and ruled in his place briefly. This is all stuff that was going on. This is the history that we then look back and tie it to what the text is saying here. So her son, Seleucus II, then succeeded his father, Antiochus II, and ruled Syria beginning in 246 B.C. And so Bernice, or Berenice probably, is the woman that the angel referred to in the text. In this verse that we were looking at. The way the NASB translates it, and then if I plug in some of the words here, again, that was verse 6. Starting partway through verse 6, we read, she, that is Bernice, will not retain her position of power, that is, as the queen of the north, but she will be given up, that is, by her husband Antiochus II, along with those who brought her in, perhaps the diplomats who arranged the marriage, and the one who sired her, that is, her father, Ptolemy II, as well as he who supported her in those times, probably a supporting patron. So you kind of have to try to look at the text and the history, and then superimpose them to see how they all fit together. Just give me a second to catch your breath before we move on to some more. So there was active pursuit to get revenge and resolution. Bernice's brother was Ptolemy III. His other name was Euergetes, which means benefactor. He succeeded his father and determined to avenge Bernice's death. So he attacked Seleucus II at Antioch in Syria and killed Laodice. So that would have been Seleucus' first wife that he got rid of in order to marry Bernice, in order to sort of solidify the arrangement between the two countries, but now they're all killed. Sounds like a Shakespearean play or something. He also conquered much adjacent territory and remained the most powerful force in the region for the rest of his reign. So he was able to keep things under control for this time. Then Ptolemy III returned to Egypt from Antioch with a significant amount of spoil, including some of the idols and precious vessels from the temples and the treasures of Syria. So again, that kind of thing sounds familiar. That's what Babylon did to Judah and the temple. He also signed a treaty with Seleucus II in 240 BC that resulted in peace between their two nations. Whew. This sounds like the common political posturing that still goes on today. Everybody's vying for power, for control, for force, for looking good, you know, all of this kind of stuff. We would say politics as usual. But all of this was known in advance by the Lord, was communicated to Daniel to give him an idea of, in one way, to verify that God knew what was coming and to give some serious, solid background to the events that are going to be coming in the near future. So, the continuing conflict between the North and the South, it's not over yet. Also, the king of the North shall come to the kingdom of the king of the South, but shall return to his own land. That's verse 9, then 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. So we'll start with that, bite off a little smaller piece to chew on here. The kingdom of Syria, or the Syrian kingdom, will battle against the Egyptian kingdom. The kingdom of Syria will advance against Egypt. So there's going to be an intention from the north to take some ground south. We don't have any formal secular history to verify or to give any background on this. So we assume that Seleucus II sought to make inroads into the area of Egypt. He was apparently driven back and was unsuccessful. That's as much as we can gauge just looking at the way things were going and looking at what the text has to say. The sons of Seleucus II sought to restore Syria's glory. So Seleucus II's son, Seleucus III, succeeded his father upon his death in 227 BC. Seleucus III is known for invading Asia Minor. He didn't serve as king for particularly long, and he died in 223 BC. Then his brother, Antiochus III, also known as the Great, became the king of the north, and he also attacked Egypt, because that's just what you do, apparently. Though Antiochus III did not defeat Egypt, he was successful in gaining control of Israel. Who would have thought? Because it's right, that's the buffer between the two of them. And so that's kind of what we'd expect. And so that was during his campaign of 219 to 217 BC. Egypt's northern border had until then extended up to Syria, because Egypt had control over the area of Israel. But then Antiochus III drove the Egyptians, then led by Ptolemy IV, back to the southern border of Israel. So pushed him back south. And he earned the epitaph the Great because of his military successes. So Antiochus was known for his ability to have military prowess. So again, these predictions don't just prove that God can anticipate history, but it set the stage for the events of the Holy Land that are going to be the primary concern of this revelation to Daniel. So if you don't catch anything else in all of this, the one thing you need to catch is the northern kingdom wanted as much territory as they could get, and Israel was in the way, and that was what they wanted to have control over. Egypt, the same thing, only going up to toward the north, and so they were fighting over this area. Then Daniel 11:11-13. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him. Again, king of the south, that's Egypt. It would be Ptolemy. With the king of the north, that would be Antiochus III here, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Ultimately, we may have some short-term wins, but not ultimately. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Again, give you a second to contemplate what's there. So the north-south battle over Middle Earth continues. Now, some of you will catch the terminology there. Middle Earth from Lord of the Rings. Hopefully it'll help you remember it, because that's exactly what this was. This was Middle Earth in the scheme of things here. The king of Egypt would retaliate for lost ground because they didn't want to give that up. So in an attempt to recapture his lost territory to the north, Ptolemy IV attacked Antiochus III on the southern border of Israel. That would have been at Rephia in 217 BC, and he was initially successful. In the process of battle, Antiochus lost his entire army and was almost captured as he fled into the desert. So Antiochus is on the run here for a bit. Egypt was able to regain all the Holy Land for a time. So Egypt then is moving up and takes control over the Holy Land, or Israel. Ptolemy IV of Egypt was proud and did not pursue his advantage at this time, even though he had killed many of the Syrians, but he did at least gain the Holy Land back, at least for a time. Syria would eventually fight back and regain the Holy Land. So Antiochus III then proceeded to turn in other directions for conquest, specifically to his east and his north. About 203 BC, Antiochus III returned with a much larger army and repulsed the Egyptians, who were then under the rule of the child king Ptolemy V, Epiphanes. Antiochus III was able to retake Israel as far south as Gaza. It's not all the way down, but it's a fair piece of it, the majority of it. You get much further than that, and you get into the Negev, and it's mostly desert anyway. So, again, you can see the fighting back and forth, Israel in the center, having to deal with all of this. And you kind of wonder, what would life have been like in Israel at this time had you been living there? When you've got Syria coming down, Egypt going up, and you're in the middle. Somehow they survived. Well, some did. Some may not have. Then obstacles to and exploits of the kingdom of the north. Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city. Again, king of the north, that's Syria. And the forces of the south, that is Egypt, shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. So, the kingdom of Syria will work diligently to hold Israel, and an unexpected alliance will arise against Egypt. So the Macedonians under Philip V of Macedonia and the Jews that were living in Israel joined with Antiochus III in opposing the Egyptians. Now it's interesting, some of the Jews here. Evidently, some of the politically zealous Jews believed that they could gain more freedom if Antiochus III succeeded, but that did not ultimately happen, at least not at that time. It seems that political calculations don't always work. You may think that if you go with this particular political leader that you'll get what you want. Is that how it works? Not always. It's often things don't turn out the way we plan, and there's always danger in the politicization of things. And I think even these Jews who thought that they were following the right people at the time were mistaken in their movement in that direction. And so I think there may be some lessons that we can learn from some of that as well. Be careful how much investment you put in political movements. That may not be what our answer is. The people of Israel found that out, that Antiochus III was not their savior. Their savior was still coming, and they needed to look to him. And so we need to be careful with a lot of the politicization of so many things that are going on today that have the unfortunate result of polarizing so many people. I mean, even in the context of the church, people are polarized in one direction over or another over a variety of things. I mean, even the whole COVID thing and all the different aspects of that, people are pulled in all these different directions, and it causes us, in my opinion, to be perhaps fighting the wrong battles. We're putting all of our energy into some of these peripheral things, biblically peripheral things, and I think the devil is winning in causing division, and we need to be very careful about some of that sort of thing. So Antiochus III of Syria will continue his exploits. The fortified city that's referred to in verse 15 that Antiochus III besieged and took was Sidon, and he defeated that about 200 B.C. He then forced the Egyptian general Scopas to surrender. He had recently defeated Scopas at Panias, that's biblical Dan, in the north of Israel, near the headwaters of the Jordan River. And there would be three other Egyptian commanders that tried to free Scopas from Sidon, but they failed, and that was in the time of Seleucus IV, coming up later. But in our present context, Antiochus III continued to solidify Syrian control over Israel, verse 16, and it was without successful opposition from the Egyptians at this time. When Scopas, the general from the south, finally surrendered to Antiochus at Sidon, the Holy Land was then permanently acquired by the Antioch or Syrian regime to the exclusion of Egypt. So eventually the north got control over Israel, and they were going to hang on to that for a time to Israel's ultimate chagrin. They thought that this was going to be the way to go, and then it's not going to turn out that way because the political scenes change, political powers change then as now. Probably, again, a good reminder for us not to put too much trust in political leaders or political policies or programs or all of that. Then, looking at verses 17 and 18, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then verses 19 and 20. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. So, wrapping up here, the last little bit. The kingdom of Syria will encounter pressure and obstacles, Antiochus III of Syria then initiated peace with Egypt, but he didn't do it willingly. He was under pressure and threat from Rome because Rome was gaining in power at this time, and Rome basically said, hey, you guys get your act together or we're going to come over there and beat you up. That was the essence of it. So he offered his daughter, that is Antiochus III, offered his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V in marriage to cement their alliance. He hoped that Cleopatra would remain loyal to Syria and to him, and would give him then control over Egypt by having that point of connection. But this attempt failed because Cleopatra consistently sided with her husband against her father, even though Ptolemy V at this time was just a youth. Then he sought again, Antiochus III sought to expand his territory again. Verse 18, he turned his attention to the Aegean coast and attempted to conquer Asia Minor and Greece. He had been somewhat irritated with the Roman authority in Greece and said that the Romans had no business being there. Of course, that's what we always say about somebody else. Antiochus did not succeed completely because a Roman commander named Claudius Scipio resisted him and was effective in doing so, and he is likely the commander that is referenced here in this prophecy. Then Antiochus III returned to Antioch, where he died a year later in 187 BC. His intention had been to reunite Alexander's great empire under his own authority. That's what his objective was. That was his 10-year plan. I'm kidding about that. It's just, you know, that's just what he wanted. That was his strategy. That was his objective. But he failed because, not because he wasn't good, because he was recognized as a brilliant military leader, but he had underestimated the power of the rising Roman Empire at this time. Of course, that's going to be a factor later on. And he was succeeded by his elder son, Seleucus IV. He was known, this is verse 20, he was known for taxing his people, including the Jews, with very heavy tribute to pay to Rome at this time. The result was that his Jewish tax collector, Heliodorus, poisoned him. And you can check Maccabees, 2 Maccabees 3:7, one of the apocryphal books, on that, because it covers the history of this time. Heliodorus was evidently the oppressor that Seleucus sent through the reference here to the glorious kingdom, that's Israel, collecting taxes. But this assassination then is going to set the stage for the terrible persecutions of the Jews that follow, because things are going to get really rough in the near future, especially as we move on to the next major character. And here, again, looking at verse 20, when Seleucus IV died, it wasn't from mob violence like his father had, or it wasn't in battle, but it was from poison again. So all of this gives background and insight into the situation that Israel would find itself in at this time. Again, it's preparatory to looking at what's going to happen with the next major character, which is Antiochus Epiphanes, that Daniel had already given us some insight on in chapter 9, and there's going to be more detail given in chapter 11 as we come back to this. But it's just, again, a reminder that even though there are those who look at this passage and they say, because of their skeptical mindset, Daniel couldn't have written this before the fact. It had to be after the fact. Therefore, the book of Daniel must have been written later by somebody else, or Daniel wasn't put in the right time frame. And the reality is, we know better because God knows better. He can give us the whole story in advance as he wishes, even if it is in a little more generic language. But we can look at that text and we can, again, superimpose the history over that, and we can see, well, yeah, that definitely lines up. That's how it worked. So now you can take a breath. Or I can take a breath. trying to take all of that and condense it down is a little bit of a challenge. I realize it's like overwhelming. You can't keep all the details straight, but you can at least remember the basic thing. Assyria to the north, Egypt to the south, fighting over Israel, and Israel was sort of the pawn in the middle that got beat up various times in the process, and they are going to be in more serious shape in the future yet. So all of that is, again, a reminder that the Lord is leading and directing toward a particular plan and purpose. All of this is preparatory to the Messiah's coming, which is the next thing. And then the next section is going to be, that we'll be looking at after Antiochus, is the Antichrist, which is preparatory to his second coming. So if we can keep those things in mind, it'll help us think through this text.